It's not a war anymore. Whatever it was, however history might dress it up in uniforms and flags and think tanks, it's over. There are no battles. There are no fronts. There is no resistance large enough to call it a war. There is only an army with drones and tanks and phosphorus and a population of starving families locked inside a strip of land so small you could walk its length before sundown. This is not a war. This is the murder of children while the world watches and refreshes Twitter. This is the sound of babies dying behind censored screens. This is a tragedy where the soundtrack is silence. Gaza's in ruins. There is a woman boiling weeds to feed her son who hasn't spoken in days, a child who dreams in color but wakes up to ashes. There's a boy wandering barefoot through craters dragging a plastic bag filled with bread so stale it could chip teeth. There's a doctor who has run out of morphine, performing amputations by flashlight with nothing but rags and prayers. There are aid workers whose bodies were pulled from the convoy, burned, twisted, the white lettering of UN still visible on the roof of the vehicle that was supposed to protect them. And there are children. Doctors say they have never seen so many infants with bullet wounds to the head. Toddlers who arrived at makeshift emergency rooms with the backs of their skulls blown out. The lucky ones die instantly. The unlucky ones linger for hours. Their parents screaming into the dark. They bury them in parks and playgrounds and shallow graves marked with plastic forks, because the cemeteries are full. A mother cradles a body that won't grow old while a father digs with his hands because the shovels have run out long ago and still the bombs fall. The Israeli government says this is self-defense, but the babies did not attack anyone. They were born behind fences in a land without clean water where they were already starving before the siege. They were born stateless, voiceless, and now they are dying in silence. There is no war. There is only cruelty. There is only empire. There is only the cold arithmetic of death written in Pentagon ink and broadcast with sanitized language. The world says Israel has a right to defend itself. Against what? Against the babies with plastic toys and sunken eyes. Against the men carrying the bodies of their mothers through rubble. Against hunger. If this is a war, then what does peace look like? A silence so thorough it swallows even the memory of who once lived here. And maybe that's the plan. To make it so quiet, so empty, so flattened and still that no one remembers the laughter of Palestinian children or the smell of their mother's lentils on Friday afternoons. To make ghosts of the living and myths of the dead to erase the evidence of their humanity until we forget they were ever here at all. But I remember. And now so do you. And what follows that knock at the door, that haunting silence, the long memory of Gaza, the land where the graveyards are dug by children and the cemeteries are layered with both the dead and the dreams of the living. This didn't start in October. You don't build a prison overnight, and you don't raise a generation to believe another is subhuman unless you plan to do something with that belief. Gaza's been under blockade since 2007. That's 17 years of siege. 17 years of lights going out like every 2 hours, like a punishment. 17 years of parents choosing which child eats and which child goes hungry. 17 years of polluted water and electricity for 2 hours a day, of denied medical permits, of watching the rest of the world live while you count each minute like it's a grain of sand in a broken hourglass. It's not a city, it's a slow kill zone. And it's not survival, it's cruelty scripted into policy. And before that, the Nakba, the catastrophe, 1948, the beginning of the Israeli state and the end of 750,000 Palestinian lives as they knew them. Villages erased, olive groves bulldozed, mosques turned to museums, entire families forced out at gunpoint, keys still hang around the necks of survivors, rusted reminders of homes that no longer exist. But even before the Nakba, the plot was laid, long before the rockets, before the blockades, before the slogans and sirens, the foundation was poured in the 18th and 19th centuries, when European powers began to imagine carving up the Middle East to serve their geopolitical desires. In Britain, imperialists sought not to expand territory, but to plant ideological flags in strategic soil. By the mid-1800s, Protestant dispensationalist movements in Europe had grafted religious prophecy onto colonial ambition. They promoted the idea that the Jews must return to Palestine as a prelude to the end times, not for the Jewish people's sake, but as chess pieces in an apocalyptic design. The Balfour Declaration of 1917 was not a love letter to Judaism. It was a policy crafted by colonial administrators to install a loyal Western outpost in the Arab world, under the guise of divine fulfillment. The U.S. picked up the torch in the 20th century and ran like hell with it. By the time World War II ended and Israel declared itself a state in 1948, Americans, especially American evangelicals, had been primed to believe that Israel's existence wasn't just justified, but sacred. Politicians learned quickly that support for Israel could be wrapped in religious fervor and delivered to the electorate like communion. It was no accident. It was a campaign. Through pulpits, pamphlets, and eventually policy think tanks, American leaders equated criticism of Israel with heresy. It didn't matter if the U.S. was arming an apartheid regime, building military bases, or vetoing every U.N. resolution demanding justice, the American people had been sold a story. Israel is the will of God, and we are its supporters. And what has that meant for foreign policy? It has meant blank checks and blind eyes. It has meant destabilization across the Middle East, from Lebanon to Iraq to Syria. It has meant generations of Arab and Muslim people growing up watching the United States fund their oppression and call it peacekeeping. It has meant every Palestinian child bombed is paid for by your taxes. Every bullet, every airstrike, every goddamn hospital destroyed. It has meant that truth is treason, that justice is unpatriotic, that to say what is plainly happening, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, genocide, is to be cast out as a radical. To say simply that they are people is to risk exile. It has meant that we cannot see the truth because we are too wrapped up in a story that is never real to begin with, a myth so comfortable we're willing to bleed others for it. This is an actual ancient history. It's happening right now. And when you close your eyes tonight, remember that someone across the world will not wake up at all. Their name will not be spoken on the evening news. Their death will not shift policy or move markets, but they had a favorite color. They had a story that's half told, a family that's now undone, and they died because the world mistook power for justice and silence for diplomacy. This is the grave we are digging. Not just for Gaza, but for our own collective soul. We cannot bury the truth alongside them. We have to dig it up. We have to scream it out loud. And if you wonder how such horror sustains itself, how the killing doesn't collapse under the weight of its own shame, you must understand the machine behind it. The gears of hate rusted with propaganda and oiled with denial spin without rest. You cannot bomb a people unless you've convinced your country they are not people. Israel has spent decades dehumanizing Palestinians in textbooks and television, in casual bureaucratic language of occupation, terrorist as the default setting. The Palestinian child with a rocket is a threat. The Palestinian grandmother with a keffiyeh is a liability. They are taught that Gaza is not a neighbor, but a nest, a threat, a disease. This is not new. Every regime that commits genocide teaches itself to look away. Teaches itself to forget that the bodies in the rubble once played soccer or learned how to spell or dreamed of growing up. When your government tells you day after day that the people across the wall are cockroaches, eventually you stop hearing the cries. And when the bombs start falling, you cheer. But this machinery doesn't run without fuel, and in the 20th century, that fuel came from Washington, D.C. And since 1948 and mostly 1967, the United States has funneled tens of billions of dollars into Israel's military, police, and surveillance apparatus. We dressed it up as strategic alliance, as a bulwark against communism, and then later terrorism. We said it was about democracy, but it wasn't. It was about dominance. We were investing in a proxy power in the Middle East, an unsinkable aircraft carrier. By 1976, Israel had become the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. That aid wasn't for humanitarian purposes. It was earmarked for weapons, fighter jets, tanks, and missile defense systems. With every new escalation, we sent more. With each bomb that fell on Gaza, each bullet that tore through a boy's leg in the West Bank, we sent more. All the while, we spoke of peace. We gave lip service to the two-state solution, but we never funded it. We never enforced it. We let settlement after settlement be built on stolen land. We let checkpoints metastasize like tumors across the West Bank. we let every American administration offer up a milquetoast condemnation while vetoing every single UN resolution that might have demanded real accountability. We said we believed in two states, but our money told the truth. We only ever believed in one. One with all the power, all the rights, and all the land. And this just isn't about tanks and tear gas. It's about the long, slow erosion of Palestinian sovereignty with our checkbook. It's about the normalization of apartheid. It's about teaching Americans that one side deserves dignity and the other deserves dust. So when Israel drops 2,000-pound bombs on neighborhoods, when it targets journalists, when it cuts off water and food, it does so with our funding and with the moral permission we have granted for generations. And still we tell ourselves we're the good guys, but we're not. Not here. Not in this. And it would be a lie to say this is only their war. The bullets may have Hebrew stencils, but the money is ours. The silence is ours. The denial, ours. We paid for it. American tax dollars, American munitions, American complicity. Over $3.8 billion a year in military aid to Israel. Every year. Bombs made in Texas, artillery paid for by your overtime, cluster munitions bought with your income tax. We are not bystanders, we're investors. The bombs flattening apartment buildings and fucking tents in Khan Yunis, they were packed and shipped with our money. The jets that scream over Rafah, paid for with Medicare cuts and defunded school lunch programs. This genocide has made in the USA stamped on every burning corner. And it didn't start recently. The United States has poured tens of billions of dollars into Israel under a series of aid agreements and defense memorandums, the Foreign Assistance Act, the Camp David Accords, the 10-year Memorandum of Understanding signed under both Bush and Obama. All of it ensured massive, unconditioned military support. In 2016, Obama signed a $38 billion aid package, the largest in American history to any foreign government, and it mandated that Israel must spend the money on American weapons contractors. It wasn't just aid, it was a laundering of violence through defense industry profits. We fund Iron Dome, we fund airstrikes, we fund the rubber bullets and the phosphorus and the checkpoints, but we don't fund peace. We've never required Israel to stop expanding settlements or dismantle illegal outposts. We have never once said no more money until you let Palestine live. Instead, we fund the occupation and we pretend we're brokering peace. We stand behind Israel in every international court. We veto every resolution and then pat ourselves on the back for hosting photo ops and issuing soft statements while homes are being bulldozed. And now we are criminalizing dissent. Under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism, Congress has introduced and passed bills that redefine criticism of Israel as hate speech. The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, the IHRA working definition, slipped into federal policy. Laws that target student groups, academic freedom, free speech on college campuses, these laws do not protect Jews from hatred, they protect the Israeli government from accountability. To say that Palestine deserves freedom, that the bombing must stop, that civilians deserve to live, this is now labeled a threat. This is a weaponization of identity to silence justice. This is the empire using trauma as a shield for its crimes. This is what we've become. The funder of war crimes and the silencer of truth. We didn't just pay for the bombs, we made it illegal to say they were wrong. And still, some cling to the myth. Not because it's true, but because it's easier than facing what we've done. So we open our Bibles and we close our eyes. We weaponize faith and call it policy. So, let's talk about the lies. Because it is a lie. It's a lie that's lived so long in the bones of American political theology that it's become gospel. It's repeated so often and with such thunder that people now believe Christ himself carved it into stone. The lie is that the state of Israel in its modern political form is the fulfillment of divine prophecy, that it is God's will, that the land belongs to them by celestial deed, signed in heaven's ink, and that any opposition to that claim is opposition to God himself. But that's not in Scripture. It's not in the words of Christ, it's not in the red letters of the New Testament, and it's not in the Torah in the way they say it is. What it is an interpretation. An idea born from 19th century dispensationalist theology, a theology crafted not in Bethlehem or Jerusalem, but in the drawing rooms of colonial Britain. This theology posits that the return of Jews to Israel is necessary for a second coming of Christ. It was never about the Jewish people. It was about their use in a Christian apocalypse narrative. And it worked its way into American foreign policy like poison into a well. Now millions of Americans believe that modern Israel is sacred, that to criticize it is blasphemy, to oppose its expansion is to challenge the will of God, but this belief is not biblical. It is not based on justice, it is not based on truth, it is a lie wrapped in theology reinforced by politicians who court evangelical votes and exploit religious sentiment to justify war and dispossession. This land does not belong to Israel because God signed off on tanks and bulldozers. Gaza is not some footnote in Revelation. There is no verse that says, blessed are the drone strikes. The Bible tells us to love the stranger, protect the widow, to honor the peacemaker. Jesus wept over Jerusalem not because he wanted a state, but because the people had lost their way. The kingdom of God, he said, is not a border. It is within you. But anyway, the lie has been told and retold for so long that to question it is to be labeled a heretic or a traitor, but truth has never cared much for comfort. And if your religion requires the suffering of another people, then it is no longer religion, it is an empire with a cross on top. Christ did not walk the Galilean hills to be used as cover for war crimes. This isn't prophecy, this is politics, wearing a stained white robe and calling itself righteous. It is the American Christian nationalist using the book of Revelations as a foreign policy manual. God doesn't grant you permission to kill a child because of a 2,000-year-old land dispute. So many Americans believe it that Israel is not just a state but a divine promise, that the Bible mandates its existence, that its borders are God-ordained, that Gaza is part of a spiritual inheritance. But let's call it what it is. It's a bastardization of Scripture, weaponized for modern-day colonization. A gospel of steel and smoke, a heresy in khakis and lanyards, signed by lobbyists and sealed in blood. If your God commands airstrikes on hospitals and sniper fire on children, then your God is Caesar, not Christ. If your theology is more comfortable with the death of strangers than the discomfort of questioning power, then you are no disciple of peace. You are a priest of war and crowns, and not the carpenter. And then there is us. The spectators, the citizens, the dreamers and taxpayers and voters standing at the edge of the fire, holding buckets and wondering if it's too late to put the world back together. This is the question that remains. What will we tell our children? Will we tell them when we heard the cries we turned up the volume on the television? That we watched a generation vanish under dust and drone fire, then scrolled past it in search of something lighter? Will we tell them that we saw small hands pulled from rubble, the mouths open and silent screams, and still said, we need to hear both sides? Will we lie to them the way we lie to ourselves? Will we tell them that we were confused, misinformed, overwhelmed, anything but responsible? Will we tell them we chose comfort over conscience and called that wisdom? Or will we tell them we rose? That when the world set fire to its soul, we poured water over the lies, and that we spoke when it was hardest to speak, that we stood when standing made us a target, that we wept and fought and refused to let silence be the language of our era. Because neutrality is dead. It's buried beneath 30,000 graves and wrapped in white cloth. It's lying beside the father who carried the pieces of his daughter in a grocery bag. It's drowned under the weight of international law used like wallpaper, decorative and ignored. We cannot look away now. Not and claim to be human. We are at a precipice, not just politically, but spiritually. This is the test of soul, of marrow, of whatever fragile thing still beats inside us that dares to call itself good. If we do not act now, we forfeit our place in the great unfinished story of justice. Because when our children ask us what we did during the genocide in Gaza, the only thing worse than telling them we did nothing is telling them we didn't care. But a reckoning always comes, whether we choose it or not. Whether we welcome it or it drags us kicking into its arms, a reckoning always arrives. Netanyahu is a war criminal. That's not an opinion. That's a matter of international law. But law is only as strong as the men who enforce it, and America won't. Not because we don't know how, but because we do. Because we've always known. And because we'd rather support the empire than justice. because we've confused divine loyalty with state violence, because we've wrapped tanks and scripture and airstrikes and morality and we call it righteous. But let me say this clearly, because it must be said. This is not about the Jewish people. The Jewish people are not the state of Israel. The Jewish people have suffered enough without being shackled to a government that drops bombs on hospitals and bulldozes the lives of others in their names. To be Jewish is not to support genocide. To be Jewish is to carry the memory of pogroms, of ghettos, of yellow stars and concentration camps. It is to know what it is to be hunted, and to use that memory not to hunt others, but to break the wheel. The state of Israel is not the Jewish people. It is a nation state backed by the most powerful military that has ever existed on the face of the earth, propped up by the United States and wielding its trauma like a sword. It is not defending Jews, it is defiling them. There are Jews in Tel Aviv and Brooklyn and the East Village and Berlin who are marching against this, who are crying out, not in our name, who are watching their faith hijacked and hollowed and turned into a war machine. They are not the problem, they are our brothers and sisters in this fight. This is not about religion, this is about power. This is about apartheid, this is about the machinery of death that has been polished and funded and passed from administration to administration like some heirloom of evil. And the war is over. There is no front line, only aftermath. There is no enemy army, only families with shovels trying to dig through the rubble. There is no military objective, only a tally of the dead. What remains is extermination. And it is being carried out in our name, with our dollars, under our watch. It is not distant. It is not abstract. It's right there. In $387.59 that came out of your paycheck this week under FICA. In the 112.04 marked for federal withholding. In the Social Security and Medicare deductions. In the income taxes you pay while roads crumble and your schools close. That money is being funneled into bombs that tear apart apartment blocks and tents filled with children. A child screams in Gaza and their leg is blown apart and it echoes down the halls of the IRS. That blood is signed on your direct deposit stub and the funeral is printed on your tax return. We are not just complicit, we are underwriting genocide. And if that doesn't make your blood boil, if that doesn't summon something ancient and holy and enraged in you, then what is left of your heart? What has been hollowed out in you that you cannot feel this and scream? We owe it to the dead. We owe it to the living. We owe it to the idea that humanity is still something we can salvage from ashes, because if we do not call this what it is, if we do not scream now, then we are no longer witnesses, we are accomplices. And if there is one last blow to strike, let it be honest. Let it come from trembling hands and a voice cracked from screaming. Let it be all we have left. I'm just a writer. And this is all that I have left. No armies, no influence, no wealth. Just these hands and these words and the weight that comes with having seen too much and not being able to look away. I'm out of thoughts and prayers and I am running low on tears. I am sick with grief and hollowed by rage and I am still here. Typing into the dark because I have to be. Because the world is falling apart and someone has to name the pieces. It's not strategy. It's not even a plan. It's just the last vestige of reason, a cry into the abyss, a message in a bottle hurled against the tide of polished boots and propaganda. It's not power, but it is truth, and sometimes that has to be enough. Because I will have to look my children in the face, so I write. I will have to wake up every day and live with myself, so I write. And once you see the truth, once you see it through all the blood and the rubble and the headlines that try to make it palatable, you'll have to live with it too. Maybe that's why so many people would rather stay asleep. Maybe that's why they cling to ignorance like a shield, I don't know. But I assure you, whatever this is, it's not peace, it's not comfort, and it's not protection. And it is still nothing compared to what the people of Palestine are living through. So here we are, you and I. Now armed with the truth, now free from the curated language and sanitized reports, now without excuse. And we have choices to make. I've made mine. Do the things that will make you uncomfortable. Do the things that will make your friends and neighbors and colleagues shift in their seats. Do the things that cost you comfort. Say the hard things out loud. Say free Palestine. They don't want it to be illegal because they care about anti-Semitism. If they did, they'd be denouncing the actual Nazis, parading through our cities, waving swastikas, and spewing hate, but they don't. They want it illegal because it's inconvenient, because it's a problem when people start connecting their taxes to dead children, because it's disruptive when the truth becomes louder than the myth, because it's uncomfortable to be held accountable for funding genocide and being complicit in its execution. So say it anyway. This is not enough, but it is something. And I offer it up with everything I have left. This is what I have. This is what I can do. I cannot launch satellites or call generals. I cannot pass resolutions or end sieges, but I can write. And I will look my children in the face and tell them I made deadlines instead of screams. I won't tell them that I worried about book launches while babies bled in the street. This is not enough. It will not end the killing, but it is what I have. My heroes would have done it better. They would have nailed this to the White House door, but they are not here. I am. And so are you. So do something. Anything. Scream. March. Write. Refuse. Donate. Organize. Interrupt. Shake the goddamn table. Speak the truth, even when your voice trembles. Because if we can't stop this, if we can't even say it, then God help us all. Let this not be the era that let genocide pass for diplomacy or silence pass for civility. Let this not be the generation that traded its soul for plausible deniability. Let us not be remembered as the people who looked at a mass grave and called it a matter of perspective. If there is any light left in us, if there is any ember of courage or decency, or love that still flickers in the hollow of our national chest, and let this be the moment we tend to it. Let this be the moment we rise, not with perfection, not with certainty, but at least with everything we have, because this is our chance not just to stand against extermination, but to prove we ever stood for anything at all. Let this be the moment we remembered how to be human. Let this be the moment we proved it. And let it not be said that we had nothing left and still chose silence. Let it not be said that we had eyes and we refused to see, that we had hearts and chose not to feel. This is the edge of the map. This is the part where the ink runs out and only conscience can guide us. This is our moment. Our chance to say that we will not let the world slip into blood and ashes without at least one voice refusing to call it normal. Let this be the moment the myth finally shattered. That power was stripped of its costume, that empire was made to shudder. So take that truth and set it free. Let it echo from rooftops and pulpits and from the broken sidewalk outside your home to the echo chambers of Congress where power hoped it would die. Let it be carved in every language and carried in every pocket and spoken with trembling lips by the people who finally understood. And with broken hearts and shattered voices and with anger and tears, let us scream into the storm. Free Palestine.